Accession number 19906, Reel 6.
Wally Blanchard, Reel 6.
I joined a destroyer to take passage to Saigon. Now, what was happening in Saigon, we were attempting, or the Allies were attempting to restore the civil power. The Japanese were still in what was then Indochina. We didn't know anything about any place called Vietnam. All we knew was it was Indochina. We did various spells of duty, including going into Macau, which was a Portuguese colony, and various other ports up and down the coast. Wherever we could, we would restore light, power and water, anything that we could do anything about. This is what the armed forces do best. The Americans in particular would bring in the heavy equipment we needed. If we needed extra source of power, we'd get a submarine in, because submarines can actually run a small town with the power that they can develop. And our artificers, people including me, I was quite well versed in some of this by then, and there's nothing like a situation like that to make you learn and pick up things quickly, pick up and borrow from other people's skills and crafts as well as my own. We were at the time engaged by elements of Japanese who'd been abandoned by their officers and whatnot, bandits of various kinds, which I would assume were the embryo form of the forces which were to cause the war in Vietnam much later on. Bandits of various kinds, some of them were purely in it for gain, obviously. Sometimes they employed children, which is not nice if you're dismounted and you're going through what appears to be a small abandoned town, mostly built in the French colonial style, and suddenly you start taking fire from the flank or the rear, or a grenade is rolled down the gutter. And when you corner who it is, you find it's a child who's been forced to do it. This is the sort of duty that nobody likes, nor do you like finding the results of Japanese barbarity, which we all too often did. And one of our duties, most important duty, was to try and locate any Allied prisoners that were still there. And the Japanese had abandoned quite a lot of them in the jungle parts. But the local population were very cooperative. We obviously were there to help them with food and aid and whatever we could do. We managed to find elements of the former civil power that the Japanese had not executed, get some kind of stability going. People like police officers and local magistrates and people like that, we managed to find some. Because we were a mixed force, language wasn't really a bother. We had Americans and all those sorts of people amongst us. These sort of duties I was on throughout that time. I went up to Hong Kong. We were up there for a while, and the Newfoundland, we were putting her into dry dock. I went back to the Newfoundland for a while, because all my papers and everything else, personal effects, were aboard in Newfoundland. And we put her into dry dock. Before we did that, there was a Japanese destroyer wreck lying in the dry dock, which, once having got in the dry dock, was successfully bombed. To do this, we employed large numbers of Japanese prisoners of war. They had to get the thing manually out of the dry dock, to the obvious amusement of the Chinese. We also, they'd erected a permanent memorial to their occupation of Japan, of Hong Kong. We forced the Japanese engineers to destroy this monument and replace it with a flag base over which the white ensign flew, and a lot of other things we did. You know, as I always say, servicemen are not primarily in the business of fighting wars, strangely enough. A lot of their duties are peacetime duties and offering assistance, and especially in times of disaster, fire, floods, you name it, we've usually got sufficient equipment to be able to handle this situation. It wasn't until, because I was now a regular, because all my papers had come through and everything else, and people were being demobilised and going home, I didn't happen to be one of them. In writing to my father, he said to me, "You're in the best place at the moment," he said, "because things are in transition in the United Kingdom," which they were. So I had to wait until I got a relief in my rank. By this time I was a petty officer, ordnance artificer, and I'd got one watchkeeping certificate, which meant that I could study to take engine room duties, which is where I was headed, if I could be, nearest thing to marine engineering. Eventually, I was transported home from Hong Kong. We stopped at quite a few ports on the way home, picking up various more drafts of people going home and whatnot. And I came back to HMS Pembroke, which was, of course, Chatham Royal Naval Barracks. But because I was a PO, a petty officer, I wasn't quartered in there. I was quartered in a smaller barracks called St Mary's Barracks, which is above and behind there, which is excellent. You don't have to go through all the spit and polish routines, and I could get home as often as I wanted to whilst waiting for my next assignment, draft or duty. I got a couple of small ones going out to small warships and whatnot. They didn't amount to more than a few weeks at a time, during which time I was able to come home and supplement the food rations a little bit with my own rations, which were quite adequate. And you could get an easy run through, crossing over to Tilbury and up through to Barking. During one of these, bear in mind I've been out of the country for the better part of 4 years, and my wife still laughs about this. Barking Station in those days was a board floor station, that is to say, of the old kind, and it was mounted above the tracks, the booking hall. So every time a train went through, all the smoke and steam used to come up. And it must have startled this woman, because I appeared out of the smoke and steam, clutching my case and a bag full of what we call rabbits. That's a seaman's small steaming bag with civilian goodies in it, whatever I could buy, loot or find from the galley, sailor's perks. Only to be greeted by this, what I can only describe as old hag, who said, "Hello, Wally, are you home again?" This is after being 4 years away. I couldn't trust myself. Of course, I said, or something like that, and I went on down the hill and home, which caused my father no amount of hilarity.
Did you have any long-term effects from having served in the Second World War?
Yes. I was not pensionable because I continued in service. But the Navy looked after my welfare, and it was one of the reasons my father advanced for staying in the Navy. He said, you'll get second to none treatment. If anything should go wrong with you, you're there, they'll look after you. And of course, well, they looked after me with regards to teeth and everything else. I was gun deafened. I never took a lot of notice of that because a lot of people were. And I had tinnitus, which I've had all the rest of my life. There's no question of that. If I hadn't got it the night that happened, the effects of D-Day and the enormous noise of the bombardment, so many hours, it would have happened anyway. Nightmares, yes, everyone has nightmares, but because I was so many years a reservist, I signed several times into the reserve because I enjoyed it. We used to train sea cadets and reservists and everything else. And at the same time, enjoyed my own civilian occupation as an engineer. I eventually served as a hospital engineer for 22 years. Some of that time I was still a reservist, but during that time I left the Navy, only to find that in 1977 there was a fireman strike, and the Royal Navy took over the responsibility for firefighting. They found me, recreated my rank of warrant officer. They didn't call me up or anything, but I was their reference point for the fire brigade, the Navy fire brigade, and we had a very good association. And a department head on the hospital commented to this commander. He said, "Oh, you know about Wally? He left the Navy years ago." He said, "Wally might have left the Navy, but the Navy never left Wally. We knew where to find him." So that's it. I did indeed receive a second award of the DSM. That was for further acts of bravery under fire. It's not considered. I was recommended for the Conspicuous Gallantry Medal, but somebody decided I hadn't done quite enough. And so that was that. So that's what you see there.
And the nightmares, were they about Normandy or about...
Yes, particularly Omaha itself. And particularly about, sometimes, years later, I would have a recurrence of struggling with that German sentry. The odd thing was that as a boy, because you used to... Boys always fight little wars. They always imagine themselves in some situation. And I used to have a bad dream in which I was getting bayoneted. On the night it really it should have happened, it was the other way around, if you think about it. I used partly his bayonet and my knife. That's what happened. But it did come back to me.
Could I ask you what you think the effect of having done this tape recording today has been for you?
Yes, I think that... probably a worthwhile experience. It may well be of benefit from a historical record point of view. Certain elements of it I found disturbing, because even after all these years there are certain things that you don't want to surface. You don't know that, but you don't want it. It's as well that they do. And it may well benefit others. I've been fortunate, along with others, members of the Royal Naval Association in particular, of attending schools and talking with children. And an extremely rewarding experience is their reaction to you. Not because you're wearing medals or you look like heroes or anything like that, but your experience of life. And their young minds ask questions that you probably wouldn't ask of yourself.